Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have some news about shocking allegations made in a lawsuit against the El Cajon Police Department, including claims of sexual harassment and discrimination. On our Capitol Report, we'll have details on the latest congressional actions to fund Homeland Security. We'll also have results of two separate investigations conducted by the U.S. Justice Department into the police at Ferguson, Missouri. And while a criminal probe failed to find evidence to indict the officer who killed unarmed teenager Michael Brown, a separate civil rights investigation did find evidence of racism and constitutional violations. On Crime Beat, hear about some accused criminals locally who accidentally pocket-dialed 911 and how they gave police an earful of evidence against themselves. We'll also tell you about a gruesome find made at an apartment in Lakeside. The California Public Utilities Commission has informed a legislative oversight panel that it's hired a criminal defense law firm amid state and federal corruption investigations, and we'll tell you about objections raised by a San Diego state senator. A California man has been indicted for attempting to help ISIL, the Islamic State terrorist organization. And right here in East County, a suit against a Lexus dealer over the death of CHP officer Saylor and his family has been settled. We'll have tips for you today on where to see wildflowers in the Anza Borrego Desert and how to avoid having your identity stolen by thieves accessing your tax return. On the second half of our show today, our newsmaker interview is with Deborah Fairbanks Verfaley with the Alpine Library Friends Association. She'll be telling us about a brand new library coming soon to Alpine that's 10 times bigger than the current one, and how the Friends organization is working to help get the furnishings and equipment needed for this new facility. And in closing today, we'll be replaying our Sounds of History interview with Descanso saddlemaker Gary McClintock, recalling the glory days of the vaqueros right here in East County's colorful past. We'll have all those stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, because East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with a report that has surfaced on allegations of sexual harassment and a quota system at the El Cajon Police Department. A 10 News report cites multiple unnamed sources who claim that an El Cajon police sergeant sent sexually explicit text message images of himself to women working in the department. The sources told 10 News that the sergeant has lost his stripes and been demoted, although he was not prosecuted. Sending sexually explicit images is a crime if the action is not consensual. According to 10 News, the images were unsolicited and unwanted. El Cajon Police Chief Jim Redmond told 10 News that the department has a zero-tolerance policy for harassment. He said he could not discuss details because this is a personnel matter. Following the 10 News report, El Cajon Police Officer Christine Greer has filed a lawsuit against the department alleging discrimination based on gender, sexual orientation, and disability. She also filed suit against Sergeant Richard Gonzalez, who is the one that reportedly texted the nude photos of his genitals to Greer and other female officers. 10 News reports that Greer claims she was passed over for a promotion to a detective position because she complained about advances by Gonzalez and cooperated in an internal affairs investigation of him. Greer, who is gay, says Gonzalez invited her and her partner for a three-way sexual encounter. She also claims discrimination based on her sexual orientation and gender, noting that El Cajon's police department has no women serving as sergeants or in management. She also contends that she was passed over for promotion in part due to disability from a back injury suffered when her patrol car was rear-ended. The report comes on the heels of an earlier 10 News investigation in which individuals within the department claimed that the department had a quota system for arrests and traffic citations. A photo showed a whiteboard with officers' names, scores, and abbreviations that reportedly indicated felonies and misdemeanors. Anonymous sources told 10 News that officers with the most arrests and traffic tickets were rewarded with gift cards for restaurants or coffee. Quotas are against the law for police departments in California. Chief Redmond has denied having a quota system, stating that the intent was only to motivate officers. But he acknowledged that the whiteboard exercise was inappropriate and not something I want to continue. El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells voiced confidence in the police department's ability to conduct its own internal investigation of the quota system, and he promised to share the results when completed in an interview with 10 News, an East County Magazine news partner. "We don't have quotas," the mayor concluded. "We have nothing to hide, and if it turns out that there is something untoward happening, we will certainly deal with that." East County Magazine has contacted the city of El Cajon for comment on these matters, but has not received a response. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Ed Barreno with the Capitol Report. The Department of Homeland Security will not be shutting down. Both houses of Congress have now passed legislation to fund the agency through September. The action came after Republican leadership finally allowed a vote on a clean funding bill without language overturning President Obama's executive orders deferring deportation for some 5 million undocumented immigrants. Previously, Republicans had voted to hold the Homeland Security measure hostage unless they could block the immigration reforms. But San Diego's two Republican congressmen, Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa, still voted against funding Homeland Security, despite the Republican leadership's change of position. Democrats Susan Davis, Juan Vargas, and Scott Peters voted for the bill. Last week, Congress had passed a 7-day funding extension that would have expired this Friday. The new vote assures that Homeland Security, which includes Customs and Border Patrol, Coast Guard, and Transportation Safety Administration employees, will continue to have full funding until September. As for the president's immigration reforms, over 24 states have filed a legal challenge which is currently working its way through the federal court system.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder on Wednesday announced results of 2 federal probes into the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department. A criminal investigation found no grounds to prosecute Officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed unarmed teenager Michael Brown, a shooting that prompted national protests. However, a separate civil rights investigation did find systemic racism in the department, and the Justice Department has ordered corrective action. Holder had this to say, "Let me be clear, the United States Department of Justice reserves all its rights and abilities to force compliance and implement basic change." Holder called findings of the civil rights report searing, adding that the investigation found a community that was deeply polarized, where deep distrust and hostility often characterized interactions between police and area residents. The investigation found that local authorities consistently approached law enforcement not as a means for protecting public safety, but as a way to generate revenue. Further, both policing and municipal court practices were found to disproportionately harm African American residents. The emphasis on revenue generation through policing has fostered unconstitutional practices at nearly every level of Ferguson's law enforcement system, the investigation found. The Attorney General says this harm frequently appears to stem, at least in part, from racial bias. Unlawful practices, constitutional violations, and racism have undermined the public trust, says Holder, creating an intensely charged atmosphere where people feel under assault and under siege by those charged to serve and protect them. Specifically, the Justice Department found that 90% of Ferguson police use of force incidents were against African Americans. And while 67% of Ferguson's population is African American, 94% of the police force is white. From October 2012 to October 2014, African Americans were twice as likely as whites to be searched during routine traffic stops, even though they were 26% less likely to actually be carrying contraband. During the same period, 35 African Americans received 5 or more citations at the same time, while 0 white people had that occur. African Americans accounted for over 85% of all traffic stops in Ferguson, 85% of all charges filed, and more than 90% of those charged with an unusual discretionary offense known as manner of walking along roadway. Police dogs were deployed only against African American suspects, even nonviolent offenders and minors. Tasers were also used on nonviolent offenders and the mentally ill. Ferguson police routinely violated the Fourth Amendment, stopping people without reasonable suspicion, arresting them without probable cause, and using unreasonable force, the investigation concluded. The department's own records showed officers often infringed on residents' First Amendment rights, says Holder, including the right to record police activities. A boy who videotaped his mother's traffic stop was arrested for no legitimate reason. Another man who recorded his traffic stop was arrested by an officer who told the jail official that the man was arrested because he, quote, watches CNBC too much about his rights. Police in Ferguson regularly charged people with multiple violations for the same conduct, with officers actually competing to see who could issue the most citations during a single stop. 14 was the most. Fines and fees from these stops amount to the second largest revenue source for the county, after sales tax. Emails reveal numerous blatantly racist comments. After President Obama's 2008 election, one email in Ferguson Police Department depicted the president as a chimpanzee, and another stated he would not last long because, quote, what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? Others stereotyped racial minorities as shiftless welfare recipients, according to an article on Salon, which documents some of the most horrifying revelations of the investigation. A man sitting in his car after playing basketball at a park was approached by an officer who accused the man of being a pedophile. He was forced to undergo a pat-down search without any probable cause, and when the man cited his constitutional rights, the officer drew his gun, pointed it at the man's head, and arrested him on 8 counts, causing the man to lose his job, Holder said. Unfortunately, the Attorney General added, this event appears to have been anything but an isolated incident. Such incidents have led to a deep and deserved mistrust of police by the community in Ferguson. Those policing practices harm African-American residents, and moreover, Holder concludes, our review of the evidence found no alternative explanation for the disproportionate impact on African-American residents other than implicit and explicit racial bias. The Justice Department issued immediate and specific recommendations for the Ferguson Police Department and for the municipal court there. These include implementation of a robust system of true community policing, increased tracking, review, and analysis of Ferguson Police Department stops, searches, ticketing, and arrest practices, increased civilian involvement in police decision-making, and development of mechanisms to effectively respond to allegations of officer misconduct. The recommendations also involve changes to the municipal court system, including modifications to bond amounts and detention procedures, an end to the use of arrest warrants as a means of collecting owed fines and fees, and compliance with due process requirements. Holder also concludes that ensuring meaningful, sustainable, and verifiable reforms will require that these and other measures be part of a court-enforceable remedial process. That process must include involvement from community stakeholders, as well as independent oversight, to remedy the conduct and restore and rebuild trust that has been so badly eroded in Ferguson. The Attorney General added that as the brother of a retired police officer himself, he knows that the overwhelming majority of America's brave men and women in law enforcement do their jobs honorably and often at great personal risk. He concludes, it is in great part for their sake and for their safety that we must seek to rebuild trust and foster mutual understanding in Ferguson and in all communities where suspicion has been allowed to fester. Negative practices by individual law enforcement officers and individual departments present a significant danger not only to their communities, but also to committed and hardworking public safety officials around the country who perform incredibly challenging jobs with unwavering professionalism and uncommon valor, he said. Toward that goal on a national level, the Obama administration in recent months has announced administrative proposals to help heal mistrust, from a national initiative for building community trust and justice to a historic new task force on 21st century policing, which will provide what Holder calls strong federal support to law enforcement at every level on a scale not seen since the Johnson administration. The Attorney General has recently traveled to major cities to convene roundtable discussions aimed at building trust and engagement between law enforcement, civil rights, youth, and community leaders from coast to coast. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
3 Alpine men were caught by the seat of their pants when they called the police on themselves. One of them accidentally dialed 911, and the emergency operator who took the call heard 2 of the men talking about getting pulled over near Interstate 8 by an Alpine sheriff. The men then started taunting the sheriff in a threatening way, unaware that an emergency operator was listening. Sergeant Kirk Thompson from the San Diego Sheriff's Department said, "We heard the 2 guys arrive at the house, and the person inside the house say, 'Hey, great, come on in, let's do another line.'" Deputies used a cell phone signal to triangulate the location of the house where one suspect lived. When they arrived, they found nearly 100 marijuana plants and bags of white powder believed to be cocaine or methamphetamine. The residents were arrested for cultivation and possession of drugs for sale. The second suspect was arrested for probation violation. The third man was arrested on suspicion of being under the influence of a controlled substance. This is Leon Thompson with the Crime Beat Report from East County Magazine on KNSJ.
Sheriff's deputies arrested a woman Thursday for threatening to shoot up a school in the Lakeside area. 26-year-old Sarah Joy Lomaine-Toua will be charged with making terrorist threats and threatening a school. The incident started shortly after midnight when the sheriff's department received a radio call reporting a possible threat of violence related to an unspecified school in Lakeside. Several schools were placed on lockdown during a search for the suspect. Sheriff's deputies assisted with the orderly dismissal of students at El Capitan High School, Lindo Park Elementary School, and Tierra del Sol Elementary. Detectives from the Santee Sheriff's Station are still actively working the investigation to be sure that there is no further threat to the public safety. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
Sheriff's deputies were trying to serve an eviction notice at an apartment on Woodside Avenue in Lakeside Tuesday morning when they made a gruesome discovery. A woman renting the apartment told them that a dead person was in one of the rooms. Deputies found a suitcase containing a decomposing body. They obtained a search warrant and found additional body parts inside the apartment. Neighbors told 10 News that the woman lived at the apartment with her disabled adult daughter, who was bedridden and hadn't been seen for months. The mother was taken for a mental health evaluation. No charges have been filed at this time. According to Lieutenant Kevin Nelson of the Sheriff's Department, the county medical examiner will conduct an autopsy to determine the cause of death and identify the deceased person. Anyone with information about this case is asked to call the Sheriff's Homicide Detail at 858-974-2321 or after hours at 858-565-5200. You can also call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477. You can remain anonymous and be eligible for up to a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
The California Public Utilities Commission needs criminal defense lawyers amid state and federal investigations of corruption allegations, the commission's new chairman, Michael Picker, told a legislative panel this week. Picker stated before the Senate Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Communications during an oversight hearing, "The organization itself might be the target of a criminal action or a civil action. We don't have criminal attorneys. This is something new to the organization." In February, UT San Diego reported that the commission paid a $49,000 retainer fee to hire the law firm of Shepard Mullen to represent the agency in the investigations. Commission critics said the action wastes public funds and is designed to protect senior officials. San Diego Democratic State Senator Ben Hueso chairs the Senate committee that heard Picker's testimony. Hueso objected to taxpayers footing the bill for criminal defense of commissioners and their staff. Hueso told Picker, "I don't remember allocating money to hire criminal representation at the CPUC." A string of emails have revealed that former CPUC Chairman Michael Peavy and staffers engaged in back-channel communications with Pacific Gas and Electric Company, promising favorable treatment of PG&E in commission hearings, including investigation of the deadly San Bruno pipeline explosion. Peavy has also been accused by ratepayer activists of overly cozy ties with Southern California Edison over issues involving the San Onofre nuclear plant and with San Diego Gas and Electric Company. Peavy did not testify before the legislative committee, the Sacramento Bee reports. An attorney from the Center for Electrosmog Prevention in La Mesa also attended the state Senate oversight hearing in Sacramento, handing each senator a press release with allegations that the CPUC covered up smart meter health dangers documented in their own emails, as East County Magazine previously reported. The release also had evidence that the CPUC helped PG&E impose high opt-out costs to force low-income customers to keep smart meters. The oversight hearing Tuesday was the first in what is shaping up as a series of proceedings aimed at getting to the bottom of corruption allegations lodged against current and former commission officials. For years, legislative oversight of the commission has been lax, but that may be changing. Senator Mike McGeary told legislators, "The Public Utilities Commission really should be rebranded the Utilities Commission. It's clear the public's role in the decision-making process is an afterthought, and the process is broken." Picker, the new CPUC chair, has promised reforms and earlier this year implemented new transparency measures aimed at stopping back-channel dealings as well as a code of ethics for commissioners. The commission is also conducting its own internal review of records, and Picker has promised to discipline anyone found to have violated state laws or commission rules. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
An Orange County man has been indicted by a grand jury on charges of trying to offer material aid to ISIL, the U.S. Attorney's Office has announced. Adam Dandatch, 21, a U.S. citizen, also known as Fadi Fadi Dandatch, is charged with one count of attempting to provide material support and resources to a designated foreign terrorist organization. two counts of making a false statement on a passport application to facilitate international terrorism, and one count of obstruction of justice for attempting to destroy records after his arrest last July. Dan Dats was trying to travel from Orange County's John Wayne Airport to Istanbul with the intention of traveling to Syria. Dan Dats told FBI agents that he was traveling to Syria for the purpose of pledging his alliance and assistance to ISIL, and that he believed the killings of American soldiers are justified, according to the court documents. Last July, Dan Dats was indicted by a federal grand jury for making false statements on a passport application. He entered a plea of not guilty and has been held in federal custody without bond since that time. According to the recent grand jury indictment, Dan Dats knowingly attempted to provide material support and resources, namely himself, to work under the control of ISIL. The indictment further alleges that Dan Dats, in order to facilitate an act of international terrorism, lied when applying for a replacement passport and then presented the passport to an airline employee for the purpose of traveling to Istanbul, Turkey. He was also indicted for allegedly attempting to obstruct the investigation by directing another person to instruct a website administrator to delete his post history on that website. Dan Dats is scheduled to be arraigned on the indictment on March 16th. If convicted of all the charges in the indictment, Dan Dats would face a statutory maximum sentence of 15 years in federal prison for the material support charge, up to 25 years for each of the two passport fraud charges, and a statutory maximum of 25 years for obstructing justice. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Days before a trial was set to begin in the wrongful death case of CHP officer Mark Saylor and his family, a settlement has been reached with a former El Cajon Lexus dealership. Saylor was driving a loaner car from the dealership on State Route 125 in Santee, August 28, 2009, with his wife, daughter, and brother-in-law as passengers. In a panicked call to 911, his brother-in-law reported that the accelerator was stuck and the brakes didn't work. The call ended abruptly as the out-of-control Lexus struck a Ford Explorer, then burst into flames and plummeted over an embankment into the San Diego River. The case sparked recalls of 10 million Toyota and Lexus vehicles, as well as lawsuits against Toyota, maker of Lexus. Toyota previously paid a $1.2 billion settlement following a Justice Department investigation that revealed a cover-up of safety problems. The payout included $10 billion to the parents of Saylor and his wife. Additional settlements for other wrongful death claims also have been paid. Investigations by the San Diego Sheriff found a sticking floor mat likely caused the accident. The United States Justice Department found Toyota knew since 2007 that improperly installed floor mats could cause accelerators to jam. Bob Baker sold the El Cajon dealership several years ago, citing dissatisfaction with Toyota over Toyota's handling of the safety complaints. The suit against El Cajon Lexus dealership alleged that the dealership ignored warnings from Toyota and further replaced factory mats with oversized rubber mats normally used in SUVs. UT San Diego reports that the dealership's legal team argued the car model was defective due to inadequate clearance between the pedal and the floor, lacked an override braking system, and had confusing button designs for ignition and shifting, among other claims. Terms of the settlement deal in the Saylor family's case against the Lexus dealership have not been disclosed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Wildflower season has begun in the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, where annual flowers, including purple phacelia and yellow desert dandelions, are blooming at the park's visitor center. The Anza Borrego Foundation offers these tips for where you can view flowers currently. In Borrego Palm Canyon, shrubs such as brittlebrush, chuparosa, and desert lavender are making a beautiful showing, especially in western canyons. Brown-eyed evening primrose and sand verbena can be found in the fields along DeGiorgio Road and alongside many of the roads throughout the Borrego Valley. A drive to the end of the pavement at the north end of DeGiorgio Road yields a variety of annuals, including spectacle pod, brown-eyed evening primrose, sand verbena, and desert dandelion, sunflowers, and even a few desert lilies coming into bloom. Purple lupine plants are widespread throughout the park, visible along the highways. Sunflower plants as well as dune primrose plants are present in fields north of Henderson Canyon Road, an area aptly known as the flower fields. Desert lilies are also blooming among a variety of annual plants along Henderson Canyon Road, just east of the intersection with Highway S2. Daytime temperatures can be very warm in the desert, but mornings are ideal for hiking, exploring, and, of course, wildflower watching. For updates, you can join the Anza Borrego Foundation's email list at theabf.org, or you can call the State Park Wildflower Hotline at 760-767-4684. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
Too many California taxpayers are putting themselves at risk of tax identity theft. Nancy McPherson with AARP California says not safeguarding your personal information makes it easy for scammers to electronically file your tax return and collect your tax refund. She says all they need is a birth date and social security number, and many taxpayers make their personal information easy pickings.
Many people fail to lock their mailbox, a really simple thing that they can do. They leave valuables exposed in their cars, and they fail to destroy personal information.
She says filing your tax return early is another way to beat con artists to the punch. A recent study by the Federal Trade Commission ranks California third in ID theft complaints. McPherson says AARP's Fraud Watch Network also encourages people to not give out personal information unless they know who's asking for it and why they need it. Also, shred personal and financial documents such as pay stubs and make sure your tax preparer is legitimate.
And I think that's where AARP really can provide help with our tax aid program that helps millions of low to moderate income taxpayers, especially people who are 60 and older, file their tax returns and get the credits and deductions they deserve.
AARP's tax aid program is the nation's largest free volunteer-run tax preparation program. Find out more about the program at aarp.org/taxaid or 1-888-227-7669. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Deborah Fairbanks Verfaley, who is with the Alpine Library Friends Association. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam.
Now, you have some very exciting updates for us about a brand new library, I understand, that's being built in Alpine. Tell us a little bit about the library, when it's going to be open, and the price tag and all of that.
Our new library was funded about 2 years ago by the county supervisors. It is a $10 million building, and after very rigorous choice of architects and builders, we have hired C.W. Driver as the contractor for the building.
So I understand that earlier today, you just had a big earth-turning ceremony up there.
That is correct.
Well, congratulations. That sounds wonderful. Now, put this in perspective for us. How much bigger is this going to be than the existing 1,300-square-foot library space that you currently have?
This is going to be 10 times bigger. It's going to be 13,000 square feet. The present library is very small and leased from a company up in Alpine and is now needing to be replaced because we have so many users.
Yeah, and Alpine has had a library, I understand, in one form or another since the early 1900s.
That's correct.
Your organization, the Friends Group, has been around since 1915, so this is your centennial year.
That's correct, yes.
Marvelous. Well, let's hear some details. Now, I understand that W.C. Driver is the same architect that designed that fabulous new library in Ramona and another one in Fallbrook. Tell us a little bit about the architectural style that this one is going to have.
This will be a very modern-looking building, but we are still emphasizing the country feel of Alpine.
A lot of stone and glass.
A lot of stone and glass. There's going to be an outdoor demonstration garden of native plants.
Beautiful.
The children's area is going to be very rustic-looking with man-made trees that will be where the children can walk into the area.
Man-made trees. That sounds charming.
They are absolutely gorgeous.
So an indoor forest.
We are also going to use some of the Kumeyaay ideas, and we will have structures in the children's area that are called waas, which are big curved
dwellings. Willows, traditionally, they would be. What are the materials going to be for this?
Now,
one?
Those are also going to be made by the company that's making the trees, and so they will be made out of metal, but they will certainly look like the thatched kind of original uwa.
I've looked at some of the photos of this online on your website, and it's amazing. It really gives the feeling of walking into a Native American village there, which is quite unique, I think, because of the Kumeyaay heritage that you have up there in Alpine. I understand there's also a lot of curves and interesting architectural elements.
Our lead architect is a man who doesn't like boxes, and so he has designed this new library with curves and areas where there'll be seating that will feel like little study nooks, perhaps, but look out onto the park.
Mm-hmm. Like little alcoves, little kind of individual niches for people.
That's right.
Yes. Wonderful. The library itself is going to be located, I understand, next to the existing Alpine Community Center?
Yes. The property for the library was bought about 4 years ago from the Alpine Community Center, and will be located just to the west of the Community Center. And we will actually share a patio with the Community Center where they have their honor wall, Veterans Honor Wall.
Ah, very wonderful facility out there. I understand that Friends Group has helped support the library through the years with book sales, books that are donated by the public, and you've always had to have your bookstore off-site. In fact, didn't have one until just a few years ago, and it's in a small building in an entirely different location. Tell us about the bookstore you're going to finally be able to have in the new library.
Well, we will be moving into a bookstore that is connected to the library, and it is really going to be beautiful. It's going to be a teardrop shape, a curved wall with lots and lots of windows. We will be able to shelve nearly all the same number of books that we have in our present store, but it will have a much more modern approach. Our present store is a little 1901 cottage.
Wow, that'll be quite a change for you then. Now, when you walk in, there's a grand room called a marketplace. Tell us about that in the main library itself.
The marketplace, which is a rather new term that libraries are now using, is a big entry area where all the latest books and literature have been displayed so that you can immediately go and find something that you think you might be looking for. Then from there, you will walk in towards the adult area where there's going to be very comfortable chairs for a reading area.
And a lot of computers also, high-tech stuff.
There's going to be, I think, around 30 computers. 12 of them will be in a special room where the computer classes can actually be taught. Others will be in other private study rooms. Mm-hmm. The teenagers will have their own computer lab as well. The equipment, the chairs in the main seating area will also have plug-in areas where one can plug in their laptop.
Very cool. Libraries today are so much more than in the past. They certainly still have books, but there's a lot more movies and videos that you can check out and entertainment, such as the Acoustic Library Concert Series. Is that going to be held at the new library as well?
Our resource room, which is going to be a separate room off the main library, will be able to have many different kinds of entertainment, author talks, music presentations, movies, teen activities.
How many does the resource room seat?
They will probably have around 200 available in the resource room.
Marvelous. There's really such a need for that out in the community. I know as a nonprofit, when we've looked for locations, it's hard to find a place large enough. Now, is this going to be like other libraries where the resource rooms, meeting rooms are free to nonprofits and available for a nominal fee to other organizations that want to use them?
I am not sure about the fee arrangement on this library, mm-hmm. but certainly there will be many, many nonprofit activities there.
Oh, that sounds just very, very exciting. I understand that it is also going to be LEED certified, which stands for Leadership in Environmental Energy and Environmental Design. Tell us about that.
This is a new classification of, well, some years now, but new buildings are to be more environmentally sound, and there are several different levels of LEED classification. The highest is platinum. The one just below that is gold. Mm-hmm. We know that our library is going to certainly meet the gold standards, and we think that it possibly will be could go to platinum, which would be the first library in the county that would be platinum.
That would be quite an accomplishment. I understand it's going to be a zero net energy facility, which means producing as much power as it uses, 65 kilowatts of solar PV up on the roof there.
There are solar on the roof, and net energy is measured on an annual basis. So it will be zero net energy over a whole year's time.
Very good. The Alpine Library Friends Association, your job for years has been to raise funds through these book sales to help support the library. But I understand that you've got a much bigger job in store now that the new library is coming. The county put in $10 million for the building itself, and you have to come up with another $700,000 or so?
That's right. All communities have to do that when a new library is built. The money goes for the furniture and fixtures and equipment that go into the library. We in Alpine will have to raise $700,000. We're about halfway there now.
Very good.
And we are still working very hard to get the rest of it.
Excellent. What kind of books are you looking for people to donate to you if they want to help with this cause?
Our bookstore takes in used books from the community. Alpinians are very eclectic readers, so we receive books on every topic you could think of. We want newer books that would have the most recent information if they're technical type books. Mm-hmm. The money that we get from those books then go directly to the library for programming. And we provide books and magazines also for the libraries from that money as well.
Yeah, and I know you've told me that some of the best sellers are mysteries, romance novels, gardening books, a lot of the same kind of things that would sell well in any bookstore.
We will also carry things that would be hard to get at the library itself. Mm-hmm. And that's important because when somebody goes into the library and can rent a book, one wonders why they would go next door and buy a book.
Good question.
But if you cannot get something easily from your library, then mm-hmm. it makes good sense to go spend a dollar or two for a book that is available in the bookstore.
Yeah, or if you want, say, a history book on East County or some of these
That's
really
right.
colorful things and you just want to have your own copy to sit up there on the shelf or use for reference, good place to get it.
Yes, that's correct.
If people want to help, where can they get more information about the Alpine Library Friends Association, Deborah?
Well, we have a website, and that is www.alpinelibraryfriends.org. All the information of what's going on with the Friends is on that website, and it also includes the architectural drawings of the new library, which would be a good place to see what is coming in our library. There is also a PayPal arrangement on the website, so if somebody wants to make a donation for the library, they can go through that website.
Yeah, and that's all
website.
Nonprofit, tax-deductible, and
that's
you
right.
also have a phone, I see, which is 619-722-1277. And if people want to check out your bookstore, the address is 2554 Alpine Boulevard.
That's correct.
Very good. Last question. When is the new library expected to be open to the public?
We are expecting it to be open in March or perhaps April of 2016, just about a year from now.
Very good. Well, we're all excited to hear about it and looking forward to coming to the new Alpine Library very soon.
I'll see you there.
Thank you so much, Deborah, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
My pleasure.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes an art reception and live music, including a concert at a winery and a famous Calypso star.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including St. Patrick's Day weekend and Easter egg hunts, Vallecitos Day historical reenactments, and Tomato Mania.
Stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more from East County Magazine. Singer-songwriter Billy Ocean will perform on March 5th at the Sequon Live and Up Close Theater in El Cajon. Britain's top black recording star of all time has sold over 30 million records in styles ranging from calypso to R&B. He's won a Grammy and topped the pop charts in the U.S. and several other countries. For more information, you can visit sequon.com.
Art in the Park, an exhibition of fine art by 10 members of the Pastel Society of San Diego, will be on display now through March 27th at Mission Trails Regional Parks Visitor Center. An artist reception will be held on Saturday, March 7th from 1 until 4 p.m. For details, see mtrp.org.
The Waits, an acoustic mandolin and guitar duo, will perform at San Pasqual Winery's Tasting Room in the La Mesa Downtown Village starting at 7 p.m. on Saturday, March 7th. The Waits blend folk, bluegrass, country, classic rock, and more as they sing and play in harmony. Wine is available by the glass. Cheese and crackers and dessert is also available. For more information, visit sanpasqualwinery.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions. The Stagecoach Theater at Grossmont College will present Romeo and Juliet with 8 performances in March, starting March 13th and running through March 21st. Based on Shakespeare's classic tragic romance, this production has a twist, set against the turbulent backdrop of Prohibition-era Chicago, blending a mafia family drama with the timelessness of forbidden love. For tickets, contact the Theater Arts Department at Grossmont College at grossmont.edu.
Tomato Mania, the world's largest heirloom tomato seedling sale, is coming to Cuyamaca College on March 14th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. This event showcases perhaps the most drought-tolerant vegetable of all with a collection of heirloom and hybrid tomatoes. You can learn how to grow perfect tomatoes in 2 classes offered at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. In addition, author Scott Daigre, author of Tomato Mania, will be on hand signing copies of his book. Admission to the Tomato Mania plant sale event is free, though there is a nominal fee for presentations. For more information, visit tomatomania.com.
St. Patrick's Day weekend festivities in East County are slated for Sunday, March 15th in downtown El Cajon on Main Street and Magnolia. Choose from a half marathon, a 5K run, or a green mile competition to compete for large cash prize pot, medals, and free drinks after the race at the St. Patrick's Beer and Wine Festival. There's also a leprechaun challenge for racers dressed like leprechauns vying to win a costume contest. For full details, visit stpatricksdayhalf.com.
Desert artwork will be on display at the Circle of Art show in Borrego Springs on March 14th and 15th. This juried art show will include paintings, sculptures, weavings, jewelry, and photography. For details, visit circleofart.org.
Take a trip back in time to life on the 1860s frontier during Vallecitos Day on Saturday, March 28th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Vallecitos County Park. This year's event focuses on cattle drives and cattle ranching along the Southern Overland Trail with cattle ranching demonstrations as well as the arrival of trail riders on horseback. You can also visit with pioneer men and women in period attire, visit a mountain man camp, and hear historical talks as well as experiencing frontier equipment, crafts, and firearms. Visitors will be encouraged to dress in frontier attire. Be sure to bring a picnic lunch since there is no food at the site. Vallecitos County Park is located in the Anza Borrego Desert on County Route S2. For information, visit sdparks.org.
The Ramona Music Fest will be held March 28th in Ramona, featuring emerging talent and popular San Diego musicians playing everything from rock to reggae and from country to Americana. This all-day outdoor event benefits the Ramona Rotary and Kiwanis Clubs. The festival will be held at the Ramona Outdoor Community Center, also known as the Rodeo Fairgrounds, at the northeast end of downtown Ramona. For details, visit ramonamusicfest.org.
The Easter Bunny train will be rolling out of the Campo Depot at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum on March 28th and 29th, and on April 4th. The annual family event includes a ride aboard the vintage train on an Easter egg hunt. For details, visit psrm.org.
Santee Lakes invites the public to its annual extravaganza on April 4th. This community event features continuous egg hunts for children ages 8 and under, live entertainment, a petting zoo, pony rides, craft booths, and carnival rides brought to you by the City of Santee and the Padre Dam Municipal Water District. For full details, hop on over to www.santeelakes.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Back in the saddle for our next conversation is Gary McClintock, founder of McClintock Saddleworks in Descanso. Gary is famous for his beautiful custom-made saddles with their gleaming leather and hand-tooled detailing. But he is equally famous for his knowledge of the world of Los Vaqueros, the cowboys of the Southwest and Mexico. Gary, welcome back.
Thanks, Helen. It's really great to be back with you. I enjoy being around you. You're such a lovely, vivacious person that it always is encouraging to me.
Oh, gee willikers. Now tell me, cowboys in general have such a hold on the American psyche. For you, what is it about the story of the vaquero that is so compelling?
You know, I think where that started for me was with Granville Martin, who I came to know. I wasn't that thrilled and overwhelmed with the cowboy as a rodeo cowboy. I was more interested in the guy that rode the backcountry and handled cattle and maybe had a little small ranch. You know, what we were presented during the 50s and all the cowboy shows that were on TV, that just sounded like a great way to live. You know, that was exciting. Not necessarily the rodeo cowboy, but the ranch cowboy. That's what got my attention. And when I met Granny, he introduced me to the whole world of the California vaquero, which was a whole different way of doing things than even the Texas cowboy.
Gary, for our listeners, Granville or Granny Martin is a historian?
Yeah, he was a great historian. He didn't plan to be that way, but he just got all wrapped up in everything. First, he was a rancher, a vaquero is what he called himself. They would go vaquero and not cowboy, and he would always refer to it that way because it was a little bit different way of handling cattle and being that type of a range cowboy is what he was.
It sounds like you're referring to the vaquero as a kind of steward of the land. That's a different
Absolutely.
Thing altogether.
Definitely a steward of the land. You know, if you look to what an environmentalist is today, they had to be that way. They had to make the land produce for them. If the land wasn't taken care of, it wouldn't produce. Of course, you had to have rain, which is what they all pray for, to make the grass grow. but they were very essential stewards of the land that preserved the land for us to what we really, it's been abused, so it's not as nice as it was in their day. I mean, there's a different philosophy that's out there with the different agencies of the government as far as how the backcountry should be handled. But in his day, it was the cattlemen that were foremost survivors. I mean, it was a ranching community, a ranching society that existed with 90% of the people living out on the land, where today it's reversed. You know, it's probably 99% of the people live.
So we're talking about cities. A whole ranching society in parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and spilling over the border.
Oh, yeah.
Into Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico's really where it all comes from. And that, you know, as they moved north back in the 1700s, they settled California and they settled New Mexico. They settled Arizona. And that was the only thing there was to do, is raise cattle. And you needed horses, so they raised horses as well. That was like making automobiles in that day. You had to have good horses, so along with the cattle came the good horses.
So there's a big Spanish colonial backstory.
Absolutely.
To the world of the vaqueros.
Oh, that's
because,
who it is.
Like, where do horses come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. But they introduced as far back as when Cortez came. Cortez was the one that introduced horses in 1519. Yeah. He brought, I don't know, maybe 19 or 20 horses with him. They were in Hispaniola before that, down by Cuba, and some were in Cuba. They were starting to raise them there. They were getting ready for an intrusion, an entrada into Mexico. It wasn't Mexico at the time. It became Nueva España to them.
Yes.
But it was just a big landmass out there that they wanted to explore.
And those horses then multiplied, or they ran away?
No, they were very well under control. The end of breeding program came along with that. That's
okay.
Those particular, there was a breeding program in the islands down by Hispaniola. That's why they had the horses there. They were breeding them there.
Oh,
and then as they
know.
Brought them over and they had the opportunity, once the conquest was done, which didn't take much, they started breeding, and some went to South America, some went to North America. So different breeding programs went throughout all of Mexico.
So it's fair to say that we have historic horses, that the vaqueros you're talking about in a contemporary sense are actually riding and herding on horses with this long pedigree.
Well, it's so mixed at this time, it's really hard to... What you say is true if you look to the Mustang. That probably has more of the Andalusian, the Lusitanos, the horses that came with the conquest. Those were the horses that propagated, and they did run loose after a while, but that was later. You know, at first, they all had to run loose because they didn't have fences. You know, they had to eat, so they let them run loose. But that's when the Indians got all the horses. They stole them from the Spanish and started their own breeding program.
Ah, yeah.
See, they really had no horses to speak of until... Really, Father Kino came into what they called Pimeria Alta, which is the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of Arizona and New Mexico.
And Father Kino is?
Kino is the one, a Jesuit priest that introduced all that. And he had very little protection, but had a lot of livestock, a lot of cattle. And he introduced it to the Indians. He wanted them to propagate them. He wanted them to get involved with ranching. And they did.
Father Kino was a Jesuit, so he predated Father Sarah, who
was
Franciscan. Yeah,
yes.
There was a kind of warfare between the two orders. If I'm recalling this correctly, Royal Spain removed the Jesuits.
Absolutely, that's exactly right.
They sent in the Franciscans.
Became very jealous of the Jesuits. Carlos III, the king over there in Spain, was thinking that the Jesuits were taking advantage of him and holding back from him taxes or gold or something. And in reality, they really were not. They had very little, and they were a very selfless people. They lived for the Indians that they were trying to convert.
Gary, you mentioned fencing, and there is that old song, don't fence me in, and which is kind of the anthem,
yeah.
The national anthem for a cowboy or a vaquero. And really, in point of fact, for a modern vaquero, how much fencing is there? Is there room to be a vaquero?
You know, Helen, that's a great observation, because it's literally gone. There's very few places where you have open range. I mean, there's some of that some places, but nothing like what was back during that era. I mean, the whole world moved on horseback. The horses were trained so well because there were so many of them to select from to begin with, after they perpetuated, especially in California. The great horse herds just multiplied. They dissolved the missions in 1835, so about that, before that point, maybe between 1820 and 1835 was when there was such a entourage of horses grazing throughout California and the Southwest. Well, from that, they could make a good horse because they had nothing but cattle and horses. And cattle, working cattle with a young horse gives them a reason to turn, to stop, to go, to back up, to do all the different things that we require of a well-trained horse. It just came from natural working, and they were better. One horse might be better than another because of natural selection. One was just a little bit better than the other one at doing this, and mm-hmm. as a consequence, if they could perpetuate that, they would. But they didn't necessarily ride the mares.
In the folklore of the cowboy and the vaquero, is there anything similar to the rules of the road for cars and boats, where you have to give way? So say two vaqueros are meeting on a narrow trail on a mountain grade. Who gets to go first?
That's a pretty interesting question, actually. Probably not so much of a reality. Some situations would develop that way. There is some etiquette regarding the herdsmen who are handling the stock, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever it is. There is kind of a rite of passage, like if you're working the right side of the herd, you don't cross in front of the guy that's working to the left of you. He shifts to the left and you go with him.
Okay.
More like a dance, you know, instead of crossing in front of each other.
Okay. And
there is that.
Is that where do-si-do comes from?
I don't know. It could be.
Are you saying that it's the tradition of the vaquero is handed down in families?
Oh, absolutely. From generation to generation. In fact, we made a video about the cowboys in Baja, and it kind of goes into a little of that and how it was from father to son. The tradition was handed down. I mean, it was unfortunate for those who didn't have as much land. They couldn't get it handed to them like me. I wasn't in a family of that, so I kind of was
I've
left out
of that. I've seen
that.
I've seen that film, and it's 1 hour, and it's very good. How could our listeners order that, or can they order it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have at my saddle shop there in Descanso, we always have copies available. Okay. And they can call us at the saddle shop. I mean, we're on the internet.
Yeah.
BrooklynTalkSaddles.com, we're there, and you can find our phone number, and everything's
right on the website, and
yeah.
Then you can order
there. It's better to call and order. I'm not set up to order off our website because I want to make it more of a personal thing.
Gary, you are terrific. Thank you so much for stopping by. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.